Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And wow, we're getting close. It's now the 19th. We're counting down the days till when Santa comes.
Yeah, and we've got a set of interesting tastes and treats today, I think, don't we, sweetheart?
I think that's what it is, starting out with one that is so appropriate.
To the season.
Yes.
God bless us all, said Tiny Tim, and you'll understand why when we talk about geese.
Well, what could you say about goose? I mean, I think of Mother Goose. I used to know how to say Mother Goose rhymes in Latin, but I guess that's not very appropriate.
I'm going to be very witty here, and you'll understand the wittiness of what I'm about to say next, because one of the phrases that's often done according to geese, which is the subject of our next interview, is your goose is cooked. But your goose is cooked generally means that you're in a bad spot. And quite the opposite is true, as we discovered when we met the two gentlemen we have on the phone today. Go ahead, and why don't you introduce them?
Right. No, this all has to do with Schultz geese. And Jim Schultz is third generation?
I am second generation.
Second generation. Goose raiser. Is that what it's called?
Goose rancher, we prefer, I guess.
Goose rancher. And how are you related to Howard?
I have known Howard since I was 8.
Okay.
Howard worked with my father to promote geese and has been related or helping the goose industry promote geese for 40 years, Howard?
Or more, yes. And my job, Ann, is in New York to try to interest the people who publish recipes in the magazines and publications where homemakers turn for recipes, to try to introduce them to goose and try to publicize how good goose is for Christmas, actually any time in the fall season.
I guess I'd like to really find out something about this company. I mean, this Goose Ranch is a family-run business in South Dakota. Is that true, Jim?
Yes. Actually, we began in Iowa. My father started with geese right after World War II.
Now, why geese?
Well, my mom found 3 or 4 eggs when she was out walking one day, and my father hatched them under some SETI chickens. And he was amazed at how fast they grew.
and they got to be a big for geese. And they got a bit big for chickens, huh?
Yeah, they grew up, and he was just amazed.
That's a true story?
Yeah, absolutely. I know my grandfather was pretty upset when my father, this was in 1949, he purchased a brand new incubator. At that time, he could have bought a farm.
Oh, no.
Instead, he bought an incubator for like $20,000, which at that time was a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And it was what was needed to launch got our family down this path.
Now, why did you move from Iowa to South Dakota, which is, as we were speaking, freezing cold?
Well, a couple of reasons, actually. For many, many years, our family delved into the breeding side of geese. In the 50s and 60s and 70s, we developed the only American breed of goose ever developed. And we sold our breeding stock worldwide. And we sold a lot of goslings to people that would raise them and then sell them to the processors.
Huh.
But being a primary breeder, you're very selective in who you keep as a breeder. On the male side, an example, you only keep about the top 10%. So you have to go to a processor with the others. For many, many years, we were hooked up with the same company, and it was a Minnesota company we would sell our rejected breeders to. And in 1979, they said they didn't want them anymore. So we had to get into the processing side of it.
This happened, actually, I understand how truthful this is, to some friends of ours who decided that they were going to breed ostriches.
Mm-hmm.
And that they would be the primary ostrich breeders. And then they were going to sell their ostriches as breeding stock. And it turns out that everybody else had the same idea of becoming an ostrich breeder.
Mm-hmm.
So they then had to figure out how to sell ostrich meat.
Correct. That's just what happened to us.
So anyway, you didn't entirely explain why you moved, but I'm guessing...
So in 1981, a plant. We were going to build a new facility. We had a small state-run facility in Iowa for 2 years we ran, but it wasn't big enough, and we could only sell into the state of Iowa. So we needed, and that Iowa could only eat so many geese. So we needed to be able to, you know, have a USDA facility. We were going to build one in Iowa, but then a plant up here in South Dakota, System South Dakota, became available. And it was interesting, as the partners up here, one was 79 and the other 63. They were cousins. But it turned out that they were Luxembourg, which was what my family name is. It turned out that the owner, he was born in the same town in Minnesota that my mother was. And there's so many nice synergies, if you will, that it just became a very good move. And what we did find out, one of the big problems on having the geese in Iowa, you had to process them very late, because Iowa, it can be warm late into the year, and geese will not put on weight or really finish out, if you will, without cool weather.
Oh, so, I see. I never knew that.
Now, it made a lot of sense for us, and that's why all the geese are now raised. And we're in northern South Dakota. We're the farthest south any geese are raised now. It's either South Dakota, North Dakota, and up in Manitoba.
And you're pretty big operation in the goose business.
We're the largest in North America.
Now, my many do you have? I mean, what does this represent? Like, how many geese do you produce?
We will process about 200,000.
Holy Moses.
That's a few, huh?
Yeah, now tell me this, Jim, because all of your material on your website makes it appear that you are not what we would call a factory farm or factory ranch.
Geese would not do well in that type of environment, and they do not.
So you do?
The nature of the animal precludes us from even trying to do that.
So what do
we
you
do? We are as free range as you could possibly think to be.
Wow.
Now, you do clip their wings so they don't fly away,
no,
I guess.
No.
No?
We do not trim any part of the animal.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, why did they not fly away?
Geese were domesticated thousands of years ago. Everyone agrees that the dog was the first domesticated animal. After that, it's kind of a toss-up between a cow and a goose.
Oh, my goodness. So they said like it.
The goose lost its ability to fly about 3,000 years ago.
Oh, I see. So they don't fly at all. They're like,
no, they can't.
They're like turkeys and chickens, I guess.
In a way, no. Somewhat. It's their structure, the bone structure has changed from the wild one to the domestic.
Really?
Okay, so they can run away, but they can't fly away.
If they can fly into a 40-mile-an-hour headwind running downhill, they'll get off the ground maybe about 2 or 3 feet, but their landings are really bad.
Now, Howard, let's talk to Howard for just a second, because Howard's all the way in New York City. And again, tell us the connection. You knew the Schiltz family for a long time?
Yes, I did, back to James's father. And the Schiltz people came to me because they had developed, Jim was saying that he was developing, his family was developing breeding stock, and they had developed a strain of geese that were not at all like the Central European kind of geese and English kind of geese that people were familiar with. Jim's breed of goose is leaner and meaner, far less fat, far more tender. So Jim's family worked that into the breeding stock, which produces an animal now that might be different from what people, going back several years, normally thought a goose was, because they always associated with Central European, you know, an oven full of fat and grease.
And nasty temperaments. Don't forget that one.
Right, and things like that. So my job was to reacquaint culinary press primarily with the new strain of American goose, so that they would encourage their readers to try it and then erase from their minds any predetermined or any pre-existing thoughts of what roasting a goose might be. I recall even in A Christmas Carol, Tiny Tim's mom, Mrs. Cratchit, spent all day with her goose.
Well, which brings us to the other aspect of this business, is that all the things you can buy from Schiltz Foods, you can buy
everything from plain goose, unprepared, to the feathers. You can buy the pre-cooked goose, which is amazing, and we did that one. And you can buy the latest product, I guess, is the smoked goose.
Correct.
And then you can also buy pieces of goose, right? So you can buy goose breasts and things like that if that's more convenient for you. And we have some of those in the freezer, which we haven't cooked one of those yet.
But you can't do the eggs. You cannot ship eggs, right?
I have just chose not to. We sell the blown eggs for egg crafters.
Right. I knew
but
there was something
to
there.
Do the food item, geese only lay eggs in the spring.
Okay, yes. Yeah, so if you get people hooked, it's really not helpful because you can't sell them for most of the year.
Correct. There's a very good reason why geese only lay eggs in the spring. Would you like to hear?
Sure,
of course.
Geese lay an egg that if you extrapolate the body size, it would be like a 150-pound woman giving birth every other day to a 7-pound child for a period of 15 weeks.
Yeah, got it. Yeah, we sort of got the message. So it's sort of not...
out at the end of that. The shell, frankly, because it is, it's the... An average goose egg is about 9 ounces, which is way larger than a chicken egg.
Oh, yeah.
So the shell on it is extremely thick, and the calcium needed for that, you can feed them all the dical or calcium you wish. They get a free choice if they want, but it has to go to the bone first. They draw the calcium for the egg from their bones. So if you try to push a goose to lay longer like they have ducks or chickens, you just destroy the animal. Their bones cannot handle that.
Oh, wow.
Well, listeners, I think what we've obviously got to do here is encourage you to go to the Schiltz Food website to find out more about the whole range of products that they have. But there's one really startling one, and what I consider a really startling development, which is the geese that you shipped us, which are already cooked before you send them. Now, what an amazing idea. And was it an invention as well?
That was. Actually, that was kind of born because me and Howard would take geese to the food editors, and I was afraid that they just would go into the freezer and stay there forever, into the deep, dark recesses of someone's freezer and didn't get tried. And I wanted something that we could take and say, here you go, try this, and have it prepped right very quickly. That's where it started. It was because of Howard.
I see. Well, you know, I mean, we've cooked, actually, not only cooked a fresh goose, but we've cooked it on a grill outside for Christmas.
And boy, was it wonderful. But it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
And there's no question about that. So then you set about saying, well, okay, if I could ship it already cooked, then that would avoid this problem of going into the deep, dark recesses of the freezer. But was there something you had to invent in order to be able to
absolutely
do that? Go ahead.
I worked with Celtica State University Meat Department for over a year to come up with the correct procedure on how to make this. Because I would not sacrifice, if you tried that, I wanted the crispy skin.
Got it, yes.
And I had to have that, because I do not want, this skin is so wonderful on it.
Oh, we like,
yeah,
that's,
I mean,
my
that's
favorite part.
Yeah, that's the best part of the whole goose, is no question.
Yeah, so how do you do that without sacrificing and losing that? And okay, that's why it took so long to come up with this.
Okay.
And yes, I tried many, many versions. I just kept, no, that's not it. No, that's not it.
But listeners, get this. I mean, Jim won't explain to you just how simple and straightforward it now is. You get the goose, and you put it in the oven for about an hour, and you've got a roasted goose. And you can do the same thing with a smoked roasted goose as well.
Yeah, you thaw that first.
It's just absolutely... Well, the only reason for that is because it arrived frozen, and we weren't going to eat it right away. We had the first one the other one you shipped, we cooked it that afternoon.
Okay. So, the pre-roasted is designed to be taken straight out of the freezer.
Right.
I wanted it as simple as making a pizza. That's what it is.
Well, it was even simpler for us. We just took it out of the shipping container.
Okay.
Well, the other odd, I don't want to say odd, but the other amazing product you have is natural foie.
Foie gras?
Well, we call it late harvest.
Late harvest, okay, that's what you call it, okay.
Actually, I have a good reason for that. We only get it in the late, latter part of the year. What it is, these geese, they naturally will
exactly
eat enough feed. And what happens when, I don't know if you are familiar with when you would process one, but when you open them, liquid fat actually runs out.
Oh,
that's
wow.
When you start seeing this liver that is, it's not red anymore. It is naturally fattened. It is a very, it's guilt-free foie gras, if you will.
Yeah.
Okay. And you only, but you only get it the one time of the year.
Correct. It is not on every bird. It's just on certain ones.
Okay, and it's their natural way of fattening up for the winter. That's the
absolutely.
Idea, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So all you're doing is you're sharing that with the rest of the world because the rest of the goose is cooked anyway.
Yes.
The goose is cooked. There we are.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's amazing how you could
get the liver to work in the pre-cooked. It just didn't work, so I can't include it in there.
Right.
I can't make it work. I can with the other giblets, but the liver, it just doesn't work in there.
And the other wonderful product you have is goose fat.
It does wonders with potatoes.
And we're trying now to market that to restaurants, as many restaurants as possible.
I'd love it.
And
it's interesting you should say that, Howard, because we couldn't quite figure out how quickly we could use 2.5 pounds of goose fat. So we indeed gave it to a local restaurateur.
Yeah, chef, he's a chef.
Yeah, and he just loved it. He said, I can do wonderful things with this.
I know, and I was watching Iron Chef on the Food Network where they did two programs on goose and were just proclaiming the wonders of their being able to work with goose fat.
Yeah.
Our most exciting product, though, is new this year, which is the Hickory Smoke Whole Goose.
Right.
One that we sent one to Jacques Pepin, the PBS chef.
Yes, we know Jacques.
He's a friend, and he served it to a PBS colleague of his, Chef Jean-Claude Serdac. Huh. And the chef then ordered like crazy from Jim, saying that this was the best smoked animal of any kind he had ever eaten. So we're trying, and what's good about smoked goose, of course, is we can make it available the year round. There's interest in it the year round. And it could be eaten chilled from the refrigerator at room temp or heated. So we're looking for this to be a big product as this is the first season we're introducing it.
Well, this is a treasure trove for cooks.
You guys are an absolute real find, and we're just thrilled with the samples that we've had. And Howard, you're just going to have to keep on peddling that goose as much as you can. And
I have to tell you a quick thing on the whole smoked goose. For years, people would give me smoked goose as like a present, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I always find them to be a big, greasy mess.
Oh, really?
I didn't like any of them. So that's why I said, and the crazy thing, this product we sort of stumbled on by accident. We had been smoking pieces to breast, but that's a different thing than this whole bird.
Oh, sure.
What we ended up doing is we kind of combined the technique from the pre-roasted and the smoked, and that's how we came up with this.
Well, listeners, you got to get onto this. The website, Jim, tell us what the website is on the air so people can make sure that they know it.
Sure.
And they can get in touch with you and satisfy themselves with goose, which they'll be delighted with, I'm absolutely sure. So go ahead, what's the website?
www.roastgoose.com.
It couldn't be any easier than that, could it? And we thank you for being practically bi-coastal, because Jim, you're fairly far west, and Howard, you're fairly far to the right. So thank you both for joining us, and thank you for the delicious food treat that you've presented us with.
And please keep us posted to see how this develops as a standard American culinary product.
Well, Ann, I'd be happy to do that. And thank you for this opportunity, Peter, Ann.
Yeah, well, we enjoyed meeting you, Howard, and also you, Jim. So,
thank you very much.
Okay, so until we hear from you again, we'll say bye. And now it's time for a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ann and Peter Haig and On the Menu Radio. What's up next, love?
Well, it's nice. Thanks for staying with us, because we're going to introduce you to a newly available ancient grain. Listen all up about einkorn.
This is so exciting. We're talking to Carla Bartolucci, who lives near Modena in Italy, and she and her husband have founded what they discovered. Carla, I'm going to have you explain what exactly this jovial company is about, which is your company, and the products, and also the einkorn pasta, which is what we see.
Okay. My husband was born in Italy. We've worked in the health food industry for about 15 years. And just look for our own personal wellness, and have actually ended up with a lot of different food allergies, and had children with food allergies. And so the Jovial brand has another look at organic and the actual origin of food and how pure the varieties of food be, with hopes that this would, you know, help with food allergies.
This was really a personal quest for
this
more
was
health.
Our personal journey for personal health ended up with the discovery of einkorn, which is the first wheat that man ever cultivated 12,000 years ago. In Italy, a lot of people refer to spelt or farro.
Yeah.
And we had, my daughter was actually in third grade and was starting to study history, and they had studied the Neolithic Revolution, and at the same time, my husband and I were wondering, you know, what really was the oldest variety of wheat. And we had visited an archaeological site here and just started to research to see how far we could go back. And we came in contact with some researchers in Italy who had been studying einkorn for 10 years, and we approached them about bringing this food back to the market, and were able to locate seeds that we planted and harvested.
How did you find the seeds? I mean, that's sort of...
Well, the researchers in Italy had worked for basically 14 years and had collected, had requested you know, a few seeds from seed banks around the world of einkorn species, and had replenished the supply. And it took them about 10 years, and we started to work with them and to actually grow this wheat here in Italy and produce products out of them. We found that einkorn was not only very nutritious, but it also tasted very good.
And it does. I can attest to that.
Yeah, I mean, the pasta it's factory wonderful. And us particularly were very concerned about how the products would actually taste, and after the first trial, everybody agreed that they actually tasted better. It's suitable for pasta manufacturing because it has a naturally high protein content, and the texture and the flavor were very, very good. And so we're very proud of the product as well as einkorn itself.
Now, you have farmers growing for you under contract, correct?
We do.
That's the way it works. So you don't own any farms, but you provide the farmers with the seed and they grow it for you.
Exactly. Because there is really no supply of einkorn on the market. We have to handle farming by ourselves. And so we have a small network of farmers in Italy who we contract with every year for, you know, it's been 2 years now that we've been growing einkorn.
How did the seeds end up being saved from that many years? I mean, it's
well,
a big mystery.
It was grown, it's still grown marginally in France, and a little bit in Italy, and in certain places, very, very, very local quantities. And so the research association that we worked with really was looking for a very pure variety, and that's the variety that we are now trying to...
This reminds me very much of, we dealt with some people in Australia who started producing frika. Do you know about frika?
No.
It's they made pasta out of it, and it's a grain out of it. Anyhow, it's a roasted green wheat, but it's not really specifically just wheat. I mean, they're going to have other kinds of frika. It's the process of this early green.
Yeah, they take immature grain for reasons which have to do with history rather than anything to do with agriculture, and then they toast it. So in a sense, they sort of artificially ripen it, but it comes out toasted, and the...
It's really good and nutty. You'd like it.
And I guess the gluten's not active in it.
Well, it's very low gluten.
At least, like, I guess einkorn, you said in your background material, you say that a lot of people who are gluten not very tolerant might find einkorn to be successful. I want to go back to the pasta for just a little while, because we visited a couple of pasta factories in Abruzzo, and we had people explain to us the difference between pasta which is made with bronze dyes and pasta which is made with plastic or nylon dyes. Now, I'm sure you must be making it the traditional way, right?
We are. We use bronze dyes. The pasta factory that makes our product is in Tuscany, and it's over 150 years old. It's been in one family, and they do use bronze dyes and slow drying. So that was the only way we wanted to make this pasta, because of the high quality of the wheat. So it's traditionally made. And it gives the pasta a coarser surface.
So it holds the sauce. So when I made this,
exactly.
When I made this with my wonderful sauce, what was it, sausage, chickpeas, and what else was there in there? There was something else in there. It sure stuck to the pasta just like it's supposed to do.
That's great.
And it was, you know, it's dark. It looks almost black.
Yeah, it has a high content of lutein, which is
healthy.
The red pigment that gives the egg yolk, you know, the reddish color, and that's what makes it look yellowish or darker.
Now, this is not your only product, although this is a miracle that you were able to revive this ancient. It's not even just an heirloom grain. It's you called it a relic.
It's basically, you know, the first crop that man ever planted or farmed. So it really is old, and barley was grown around the same time. It was picked from the wild and farmed by man in the Fertile Crescent. But the interesting thing about einkorn was that about 5,000 years later, after they had domesticated it, it started to be replaced by other forms of wheat, like emmer and spelt. And it doesn't really grow well in warm climates, so it wasn't really used very much in Egypt. They used more emmer. And so it never became a real popular crop. And this was really, to us, it's saving grace, because to us, we feel like it's one of the few foods that was really preserved in time and not really manipulated by modern agriculture.
Right. Now, but you do have other products as well. They're all united by the concern for purity and health, right?
Exactly. We also make a gluten-free brown rice pasta, which is also made traditionally with bronze dyes and slow-dried, and it's made with select varieties of brown rice that we also grow here in Italy.
Now, what is your distribution?
Our distribution, the einkorn is available nationwide in Whole Foods Market and most, you know, leading retail natural food stores.
Okay. And the others is, do you do any internet marketing?
We sell on Amazon.com, and we will soon have an online store and more product coming in the next year.
And so what will it be called? Jovial?
Jovialfoods.com.
Where did that name come from?
Well, I think that my husband and I sort of moved into the second half of our life and had learned a lot. We're looking forward to a jovial second half, and that's where the name came from.
And more, where does the word einkorn come from?
Einkorn means one grain in German, and I guess the Germans were the ones who actually created the name that was adopted to English, because when you, there's only one grain on the spiglet, it's different than wheat, and that's why they call it one grain.
Oh, interesting. Now, don't forget, you must go to see our friend chef owner, Massimo Battura, Osteria Francescana, but make sure he's there when you go, because he travels quite a lot.
Can I tell him that you sent me?
Absolutely. Sure. If you let him know that On the Menu sent you there, I'm sure that he'll take extremely good care of you. I would strongly recommend going at lunchtime, because it's so much quieter, and when we were there, he brought out every dish himself and explained it to us, because he was able to do that because the restaurant wasn't so busy.
His wife is American, actually.
I've read that in the paper. I'm gonna make it a point to go there soon.
Great.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and we wish you continued success. A somewhat unconventional venture.
I'm glad that we can get it in Whole Foods, because I was wondering how I was going to get more of this.
so there you're okay.
Oh, that's great.
So, Carla, say ciao to your husband for us, and thank you so much for joining us on the menu.
I will. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Carla.
Okay, bye-bye.
And now, another short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, we're back, and we're bringing you brownies.
And I ate all of them.
Yes, you did, actually. Even the blondies.
And they were really good. And you should have some, too. And the great news is you can either buy them or you can make them yourself. What a deal.
Patricia Helding, how did you get from being a Wall Street trader to being a brownie maker?
Well, one of the things, from being on Wall Street, one of the things that helped me relax in the evening was going home and baking. And I started baking brownies, so they were my favorite thing. And I would bring them in to work the next day. Obviously, I couldn't eat them all. And people went wild for them. And I was trying out a lot of recipes, finally hit one that I really liked. And at a certain point, I decided to trade in the trading, an apron and an oven mitt.
But a bit of sugar high is really exactly what a top Wall Street trader really needs, huh?
Of course. Just make yourself spend a little bit more.
Yeah, get even more hyper if you can.
Exactly.
Well, the name of your bakery and your company is Fat Witch Brownies, and I have to tell you, I just think it's the cleverest name. You can tell us that story if you want. And also, the packaging is wonderful. Your Fat Witch appears on all your cards. I love the square box of the samples that you sent with the little small bites of the brownies in it. And you sell 2,500 of these a day?
We do almost 2,500 a day. We bake 2,500 a day.
Okay, so you named this company after a colleague who pigged out on your brownies.
Yeah, she had a laugh just like a witch, and she would swoop in when I would bring the brownies in, and I'd say, careful, you're going to be a fat witch. And she would just laugh just like a witch.
Now, is she still a trader, and is she a customer?
She has moved on also.
Is she a customer?
Yes, she is. We're still friends.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you are really surreptitiously creating a demand for your product by sneaking it into people's diet, so that now of course they can't do without them.
Exactly. And actually, the trading floor, a lot of those people are still customers. They were my first, and a lot of them still are.
Now, the subtitle for your book is Brownies, Blondies, and Bars from New York's legendary Fat Witch Bakery. I guess we should point out that you are in New York, and you actually have a bakery?
We actually have a space, a retail space in Manhattan in Chelsea Market.
What does it look like?
Hmm?
Oh, you're in Chelsea Market.
We are in Chelsea Market.
Oh,
yes.
With Amy's Bread, my buddy
with
Amy?
With Amy's Bread, absolutely.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen her in a couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah, we usually would make a detour to see her.
Well, we went through the Chelsea Market place, but I think we must have been short of time or something like that.
Well, this was, yeah. No, we haven't been.
We didn't stop for a brownie either, but that's something.
Well, hopefully you'll stop and get a sample. We almost always have samples out.
Now, I liked the brownie, the original brownie that you did, but a lot of people have their own special favorites, right?
Yes, almost everybody. A lot of people have their own way of making brownies, and almost everybody remembers baking with their mom and so forth. But, you know, we use Ghirardelli chocolate, which gives it a slightly different taste. And a lot of people like our blondies also. They would take a blondie over a brownie.
Well, I never knew you could do so many things with brownies. You have this over-the-top section, and I know that's not what delicious decadence you call it.
Yes.
And I never even thought. First of all, who would top a brownie with icing?
I know. You know, I'm not. That was a really hard decision, and most of the time we don't do it in the store, but people do like icing. So we included some. I mean, like, for New Year's Eve, we always do a champagne icing.
Oh, wow.
On the brownie. So I included that sort of thing.
Well, we had a dinner party, and somebody was baking brownies to bring them, and some and we had a company send us a sample, also from Vermont, of a goat's milk caramel.
Fat toad goat's milk caramel.
So the fat wish and fat toad should get together because this caramel topping is fabulous.
It's absolutely wonderful.
Goat milk.
Fat toad. That's the name of the company.
Fat Toad.
I'm sure if you Google them, you'll find them. And if you have any trouble, just let us know and we'll put you in touch. But
the caramel topping is fabulous.
Yeah, it would be an alternate to the other icings that you mentioned and would go really well.
Yeah, she's the caramel witch here.
it's really a favorite taste of Americans, I think.
Oh, well, it's all of a sudden it's like having some kind of major revival.
Yes.
Like the salted caramels, like Fran does,
But there's something about doing it with goat milk.
Yeah,
I just had I don't know whether it was from them, but we were in a pop-up store next to the Gap on Fifth Avenue called Cool Hunting, and they've taken all local things, and we're lucky enough to be one of the local New York things, and they had a goat milk caramel.
And it comes in a little jar and a big jar.
It comes, I would say, 6-ounce jar, and they also put scotch in it.
Oh, well, I don't think these guys are doing scotch. Anyway, it would be a good
connection. I would love to get to know them.
But you got two, the interesting thing is you got two ways of going with Fat Witch. You can buy the book and make your own, which is longer, but probably in the long run less expensive.
Oh, yes.
Or you can just indulge immediately. And if you're not in New York City and you can't go to the Chelsea Market to get some, how can you lay your hands on some in distribution?
We've got a website.
Okay.
So you can go to the website and have it shipped. Are there places you can actually go get one?
There are in New York City, but because our brownies have no preservative, we don't sell to California or really out of our area.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but there are places in New York where you can buy them as well.
Yes.
Because I think most people, if they want a brownie, they want it now.
Or
5 minutes ago. So
that's a good point. Well, I always think it's a good idea to have a cookbook. And we also have a mix where you can make them.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's sort of a no-fail.
It's a no-fail. And because I own a bakery, whenever I give a dinner party, I always forget to bring home brownies.
I
am always scrambling. So I usually have a mix at home, or I'm opening up the book, and I use it myself. Okay, what do I have in the cabinet that I could put together?
Well, you couldn't have made it more simple for people to make these brownies. All they need is an 8x8-inch baking pan.
For the cookbook, it's a 9x9.
I mean, 9x9 baking pan.
Every recipe has been adjusted for a 9x9-inch square pan.
I mean, I just think it's fabulous. And you show throughout the book ways to make these into really classy gifts.
It's one of the things that actually the editor wanted us to do. She said, you're known for your packaging. And I thank you very much. And so we went back and redid some, got the photographer back, and added those later.
Well, now I think there's only one piece of information left that we need, and that's the website. And if on the website, there's also a place you can find out where you can get some in your neighborhood.
I don't have a place on our website where you can get them. It's kind of a moving target.
Okay.
You will have. I know you will.
But, and also that every store sort of orders different things because we have 8 different kinds.
Okay, I got you.
And so that I thought about it, and maybe I should be doing that. But our website is fatwitch.com.
Very good. Well, I think it's a delightful read as well, because you're a very witty, funny person. So.
Well, thank you. And there's one last thing, because I know you have such an international audience.
Yeah.
I was so impressed with that I would like the audience to know that brownies are one of the few all-American pastries, things that we've invented here.
Well, Peter's mother, who was a real dessert freak, she used to talk about freakum. She used to freak out when my mother would get her brownies when she came to visit us from the UK. Peter's English.
Oh, yes, yes.
I read that.
Yeah.
We're a sweet tooth nation, and it's really amazing that the English did not invent brownies. It's actually quite possible. I suspect that George Washington stole the recipe from Lord Cornwallis.
I think he stole gingerbread.
I think he probably stole brownies as well.
Okay.
And we wish you tremendous success, and we hope you make more.
And I'll look forward to seeing you sometime.
I hope so. Let me know when you're in New York.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Patricia, thank you, and good luck.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And if you don't have a sweet tooth, we have another new snack for you. Amazing. Yeah, who thinks of these things? This new one is called Popcorners.
And you'll find if you have them, you won't be able to put them down.
I wonder if anybody's ever had kind of snacks that they get on a plane influence the reason why they choose a particular carrier. You'll understand the reason why I'm speculating about that as we get further into our conversation with our next guest, who is...
Linda Fishman.
From?
Medora Snacks. But really what we're calling it now is Popcorners. Anyhow, Linda, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you.
Where did you get this idea? I mean, basically, this is popcorn squished into a chip.
Well, it's formed into a chip.
Formed, yes.
Our basic ingredients are corn, oil, and salt, which is what popcorn is made from.
Right. But it's real popcorn.
Yeah, it's real corn. We devised a special method of creating it in a chip.
It's amazing. I mean, I just can't imagine. Who ever thought of it?
Well, we do a lot of brainstorming here at the company.
Okay. Uh-huh. Sounds like it.
And somebody put together the fact that the fastest growing segment of the snack market in the United States is popcorn, but that some places don't like it because it creates a mess and a choking hazard. And as I told you, it was reported by somebody who tried it at my house, that popcorn gets in your teeth and corners don't.
Correct.
So they're a snack chip, but it's popcorn.
That's exactly right. And we have five different flavors. Like flavor is sea salt, which is just, as I said earlier, the three ingredients.
That's my favorite one.
That's corn, oil, and salt.
I love that one.
And then we have butter flavor popcorn.
Well, that's okay, yeah.
And white cheddar.
Which I like too.
Kettle, have you tried that?
Yeah, I didn't like it because it has sugar in it.
Oh, okay. But that's actually, right now, that's the one being served on all JetBlue flights. Okay.
Well, everybody in the world likes sugar except me, so.
Actually, this week we just came out with another flavor, cheesy jalapeno.
Oh, no, I'd like that one.
Which is a bit spicy.
Yeah, I'd like that one. Oh, yeah,
that's wonderful.
Now, where do you get this?
We're working on our distribution right now.
Okay.
We do sell through our website, and we do give free shipping.
Okay, what is the website?
Popcorners.com.
Okay, that's Popcorners. You get it?
Yes, Popcorners.
Right.
Yeah, well, they're actually triangles.
They're trying.
Exactly, and there's three corners on every chip.
Sure. Well, unless it's round, it's going to have three corners or four corners. it's going to have at least that many. I guess it's not a silly question, but why has nobody done this before?
No one has the technology that we have.
Okay, go ahead and explain it a little further.
Well, I can't get into too many details because it's a secret.
Okay,
but
all right.
We have machinery that we've developed.
Okay.
That enables us to take these ingredients and make them into a chip through heat and pressure, just like popcorn.
Okay.
Now, who's in your company? I didn't even know what your title is.
Well, I'm the president of the company.
Okay. You're a founding person? I mean, you're a founder?
Yes.
Okay. And who else works for you that you brainstorm and come up with popcorners?
Well, we work with our manufacturing facility. We work with our salespeople. We have salespeople all over the country. We have marketing people outside marketing people and in-house marketing people. And we try to get the pulse of what the people want.
Now, you were in this business before working for somebody else, right?
Yes. I've worked for two other companies in the past, and I've always worked with healthy snacks because we need to feed the people much healthier than they're accustomed to.
Oh, yes, and there's one very important attribute that we mustn't forget. These are gluten-free, I believe.
These popcorners are gluten-free. They're not fried. They have no trans fat. Their calories are very reasonable. Approximately 120 calories a serving.
Which is a whole bag. Yeah.
Exactly. And we do come in different size bags. We have the self-consumption size, which is a 1.1-ounce serving.
Is that the one?
And we have a family pack that's a 5-ounce serving bag.
Oh, well, they're addictive, I have to tell you that. I like Peter, I can't believe nobody's come up with this before.
I have been known to open one and eat it and then say, you know what, I really need another one.
That's why the family pack is so wonderful.
Well, I don't. It would take me a while to do 5 ounces.
Yeah.
They might get stale by the time I get there.
I mean, I'm
no, believe me, you'd eat them quite quickly. I sometimes sit at my desk, and while I'm working, I don't realize, and I look down, and the bag is empty. Because as you did say, they are addictive.
Yes, and I took them to the gym, and they moved, especially the sugar ones, moved really fast.
I almost dared ask you. No, you're not going to be a one-product company, I'm sure. So,
no.
Can you reveal anything about what you're working on, or is that all too secret?
Well, we are working on more gluten-free products.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
good.
Well, you're right on trend there.
Yes.
Anyhow, I think I never thought there'd be anything new under the sun in snacks, and you came up with it.
So there you are. So back to my comment at the beginning, you realize it slid right on by in the conversation that JetBlue is having trouble keeping them in stock on their flights because people love them so much they're stuffing several in their pockets to take away.
Exactly. We actually had a person call us up. They got off the plane.
Oh, no.
In Florida, and called us from the airport. When she rents her car, where can she go buy them?
Oh, wow.
It amazes us how the consumers are just demanding them. So we're working on getting them into more and more retail outlets.
Okay. Well, until then, order them online at the website we mentioned,
popcorners.com.
And free shipping and the whole thing. And
yes,
Linda.
We also have, I'm sorry to interrupt, we also have a store locator. If you put your zip code in,
we can
help you find a store near you.
That's great. And Linda, will you remember me when you're a billionaire?
I will always remember you, Anne.
She's going to go into the same category as Mary's Gone Cracker.
Exactly.
Mary's Poppin' Crackers.
Yeah, exactly.
No, there is actually a snack food called Mary's Gone Crackers.
Which I love. Have you tried that one, Linda?
No, I have not.
Oh, it's also...
They're gluten-free, too.
Yeah, because she has the gluten allergy. She's celiac.
I thought it was her husband who had a gluten allergy.
No, she did.
Okay, she did. So they invented a gluten-free cracker. It's more like a cheese cracker than a snack food.
Okay.
No, she has the sticks and twigs.
Oh, she has sticks. I forgot about sticks and
twigs.
Oh,
yeah, I love those things. I can never get enough of them. Okay, sticks and twigs and popcorners. I'm all set.
Well, congratulations.
We're very creative out there these days. We have to keep the consumers keep guessing.
Right.
What do we say? This is a Horatio Alger story. Congratulations.
Okay, Linda. Well, thank you for talking to us about it.
I hope everyone enjoys their popcorn.
Oh, they will. And keep us posted on your new developments.
Absolutely will. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Linda. Bye-bye. And now we'll pause one more time.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station. www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, Mrs. Rabbit. What's up next?
Well, we get lots and lots of books about flavor, of course, because of our concentration on the world of food. But I must say that this current book, the next interview we did, is uniquely creative in the flavor combinations. And he doesn't reference anybody else. He just dreamed them all up by himself. Let's listen to the Cook's Book of Intense Flavors.
Mr. Krause. Chef Krause from Lawrence, Kansas.
Just when you think you know or understand the landscape of flavor and flavor combinations, along comes this wonderful book. And when I say wonderful, I mean it's just delight, opening whole vistas of new adventure in flavors. The book is called The Cook's Book of Intense Flavors. And the authors, we have one of them now, Robert and Molly Krause, is it?
That's correct.
Yes. And we have Robert on the phone. Molly was not available. And these are chef owners of a particular operation called the Krause Dining Restaurant.
featured in Food and Wine Magazine's annual 100 Tastes to Try issue. Well, congratulations on that. You were number 11, were you?
That's right. You're number 11.
Yeah, well, that's putting you way up there. I don't know how you ever got these kinds of combinations of flavors. Do you just regularly experiment with flavor combinations?
Really, the book evolved from our style of cook, and the ingredients are things that we have in our kitchen every day. So the method of putting them together a lot of times would come out of necessity rather than just the intent of trying different
things. You were saying before we came on the air that sometimes you would look around the kitchen and say, oh my goodness, I have to use it now. How can I do that?
Right. And so in running a professional kitchen, there are no leftovers. There aren't things that you say, oh, well, we'll just throw those out. I mean, it's all product. It's a possibility for inspiration in making a new dish or putting together some different flavor combinations. And this has been my style of cooking since I was young and just getting out of culinary school. So putting this book together and working with my wife Molly on it seemed to be a natural way of categorizing different dishes.
In a way, we and you were quite lucky, you were telling us, because you were trying to place a book, and it turned out the people you were trying to place your book with wanted you to write a book on this subject that you chose instead.
Right. Yeah, the publisher already had this idea, and we had talked to them about a different book that we were wanting, or that we had already submitted, and they liked the flavor combinations, and we thought, well, this is a perfect book for us to write. So we started putting down recipes. We started looking through our mental archives of dishes that I have made over the last 30 years of my cooking career, and the dishes that we were making that were relevant to this book that we were preparing for our dinner guests. A lot of the recipes that came out of this book, the majority of them actually, were dishes that we were preparing for our customers over the last 8 years since we had the restaurant Krause Dining.
I thought we should just go to the outline so that people have an idea of how this is all organized. You have a number of chapters with names such as Timeless with a Twist, Unexpected Pleasures, Complex Concoctions, Bright and Light, Sweet and Sour, which has interested me a lot, Exotic Flavors, and Decidedly Decadent. Then in each of these chapters, according to the theme of the chapter, you have cute names. You said your mother did those, like Brunch and Valley. Yeah. But anyhow, you list three ingredients, and in this one it's bacon, egg, and mango. And so you talk about these ingredients, and then on the opposite page, you have a recipe, apple smoked bacon frittata with mango chutney. And you also give suggestions for how else these combinations of these particular ingredients could be used. Now, did I explain that clearly?
You did a very great job.
Great.
Why don't you take a couple more of your favorites and do the same thing with them?
Well, what we wanted to do was to throw out three of the unusual flavors in a dish, then to explain a little bit about how we see those flavor combinations being able to work together, give an example recipe of something that we have made that we thought worked well with those flavor combinations, and to give people a clear idea that, yes, in fact, they may not sound like they work together, but if you use those three ingredients in this combination with the addition of these other ingredients, that you can come up with a dish that's not only unusual, but is balanced, that has right flavors. We're very concerned about people eating well. We want people to eat healthy. We want people to be satisfied by their food. If you eat a diet that's all salads, you'll end up eating a bunch of candy bars at the end of the night because you're not eating a balanced. So what we're trying to do with this book is a number of things. Give people a different way to look at, give them some different ideas on how they might create a dish, not necessarily with only the recipe that's in here, but give people an inspiration to think about the food differently. and think about how they can take these three ingredients, take that recipe or the information we've given them, look in their own refrigerator, and apply it to something that they may need to use or want to use, just like me.
See, I never would have thought of parsnip, ginger, and basil. That, to me, I wouldn't know where you'd start getting that.
Well, it's in the book.
It's in the book,
and it gives you a lot of different ideas, a lot of different direction with ingredients that you may not think. People don't necessarily think of bacon and sweet, but if you really think about the best bacon that you may have ever eaten, it almost always has some sweet element, even if it's maple glazed or smoked, and the smoking process is bringing the sugars out. And so, and then, you know, and hearing those ingredients, parsnip and basil, if you read further, there is an Asian recipe or an Asian based recipe with Thai basil oil, and it all starts to make more sense once you get into it a little bit farther.
You love fennel.
And we love fennel, too. Fennel is one of our favorite ingredients. It's actually in this book a lot more than it's mentioned. There's a lot of these dishes that when I'm preparing something, when I have fennel on hand, it automatically slides into a dish because I have it, because it's so versatile.
Yeah, well, fennel fronds is one of the few herbs we have left in our garden right now, so I've been using that in a saffron and pastis combination with cod, which has been working out very nicely. As it turns out, tonight, planning on cooking some pork chops, which have been marinating in barbecue sauce since yesterday. I was inspired, think I'm on the right track, because you have a recipe for bacon, beans, and vinegar. And the barbecue sauce I was using to marinate it with was quite a lot left in the bottle, so I poured some sherry vinegar in it to wash it out.
Very good.
So there will now be vinegar in that, even though there originally wasn't supposed to be. But I know it's legit.
Well, that's, you know, part of the secrets of cooking, that, you know, a little bit of something that you may not think is right, because you think of vinegar as a very strong, forceful flavor. So in using a little bit of a high acid ingredient like vinegar in a dish, so that it's not the predominant flavor, can bring out the flavor of the food. That's why we've got a whole chapter on sweet and sour.
So the agrodolce is, I mean, I grew up on that, Sicilian agrodolce, yeah.
Sure.
So I have to ask you a question. I think your photographs are just lovely, but why are you using that skillet, the Teflon skillet, where half the Teflon's worn off? I mean, that's not even safe, is it?
Well, it's a good question. And it's really part of being in the restaurant business that you end up with a pan that you originally use for fish and egg, and then once it's become scratched to a certain point where it's no longer useful for those dishes, you take a metal cleaner and you scratch the majority of the flat part of the skillet off, so that those things are not really relevant, and you can use it for all kinds of saute and stuff. And it's
again, looking at it here with your cumin, cinnamon, and cocoa, which is also a fabulous combination, isn't it?
It's great. That was something that I came up with when I was living in San Francisco, and I was making Mediterranean spice for squab that I was working at a restaurant just opened called Gary Danko's in San Francisco.
Oh, he's a good friend of ours. Did you see him on our website?
I didn't see.
First page of the website is a picture of me and
up,
Gary.
Yeah, there's a picture of Ann and Gary the first time we went to his restaurant, talking in the kitchen, pointing at each other, I think.
No.
And trying to get it worded edgeways.
That was a long time ago, I don't remember.
We've been there three or four times.
Yeah, I mean, we know. He's on the interviews are on our website.
So he's such a great guy.
He's a great guy. He was a terrific guy to work for. Probably the most difficult job that I ever had.
Why is that?
Well, the concept of his restaurant and being able to order your own courses in the number you wanted them determined how big they were going to be. So there could be a table that would have a person ordering 3 courses, 5 courses, and 9 courses. So
difficult, yeah.
And if you were ordering the 9 courses, you may have some of the same dishes, but they were all slightly different in size, and it was all parade service.
See, that would be difficult.
And so my job as sous chef or expediter, I would have to coordinate everything that went out of the kitchen and
wow.
enough people to carry it out so that it was all served properly. But at the time, Nick Payton, who is now...
Yeah, we know him at Cyrus.
F. Cyrus, yeah. So Nick was running the front of the house of Gary Danko's at the time, and that was truly one of the great privileges of my career working with Nick Payton.
So you really learned a lot from him.
Well, I learned more about working in the front of the house than in my previous 30 years of being in the restaurant.
There you go.
Now, here's another. I have to mention this one. Date, chestnut, and paprika. This is the best excuse for getting chestnuts that I've ever seen.
Yeah, there's a lot of things to do with chestnuts.
Yeah, my Swedish friend just boils them and serves them with butter and salt, which doesn't really get my attention.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of people, and people in this area, people everywhere, that tend to want to cook in a very simple fashion. They think by using three ingredients together that they can come up with a wonderful dish, and I don't necessarily disagree with that. I just don't cook that way. Mm-hmm. My mind doesn't think about a dish being complete until it ends up being rather complex.
Uh-huh.
That's just my style of cooking, for better or worse.
But that's when you cook now. What you've captured is the essence of the idea of the three ingredients together really changing something that's reflected in this book. So it's not completely the way you cook in your restaurant.
It's not. The three ingredients are bases. They're the basis for this unusual flavor combination. But as you'll see, I mean, even the simplest of dishes in this book end up having more and more ingredients. The braised duck dish, I mean, by the time it's done, if you really look closely at it and all of the seasoning ingredients and stuff that go into it, it ends up being pretty complicated. So that's where Molly really helped me in putting the recipes together for this book and trying to keep a certain amount of simplicity so that people aren't overwhelmed. That's why there's a specific chapter in this book that has more complicated dishes.
Yeah, you said the one thing you need to commit is time to executing those dishes.
Yeah, those are the ones you cook on the days when you decide to stay home from work.
Yes, I mean, or you have a weekend and you really are feeling inspired, or you have guests coming over that are important to you, people that you really love enough to want to put some real effort into it. It's not an evening where you're just trying to put food on the table for your
right.
family.
Right. Well, this is a fascinating concept, a fascinating book. Well done, not for the squeamish, I guess, in terms of prepared to spend some time on preparation. Let's repeat. Do you have the title facing you, Cooks?
The Cook's Book of Intense Flavors, and the subtitle is 1, 2, 3 ingredients equals 101 surprising flavor combinations and extraordinary recipes that excite your palate and pleasure your senses. And it certainly does, Robert. I mean, I just think this is a major contribution to adventure in cooking.
And if you can't cook worth a damn and you can't find a friend to cook for you, you'll just have to go to Lawrence, Kansas, Robert and Molly's restaurant, which is called, Robert?
Krausy Dining
in Lawrence, Kansas. So you have no excuse now. You either make it yourself or you just go find out what it tastes like.
Well, we have, to promote ourselves a little bit, we have a Latin American restaurant that we opened this year called Esquina. It's in a historical building that has always been the Round Corner Drug.
Oh, wow.
So we've opened that this year, and then we also opened a restaurant called The Burger Stand at the Casbah. So we've got a couple other ventures that we're working on that are already open.
Do you have a website you could share?
Yes, it's esquina.com.
Esquina.
Esquina Lawrence. There's another Esquina in Manhattan, and it's obviously another Latin American restaurant that doesn't really have the same style of food that we're serving, but it's been really fun. Been really great. I really appreciate having the opportunity to talk to you two.
Yeah, well, it's a good excuse. I mean, when we lived in Kansas, Leawood, Kansas, near Kansas City, Missouri, The only restaurant in town, aside from the Bryant's Ribs, was the American Place. Where did she go, Tina Pohl? Tia Pohl?
Well, there was a couple that were chefs there for quite a while.
And they were at the sardine thing.
And they moved on, yeah. And the chefs since then, I don't really know them.
So, but it sounds like there's a lot more opportunities for good food now in that part of the country.
Yes, the food in this area is pretty good. Lawrence is a small community with a lot of variety, probably as much variety as Kansas City, and it's a small university town of about 100,000 people.
Yeah, well, I've been there, and look up my friend, Colette Bangert, the painter.
I will. I will, absolutely.
And please give our best to Molly. And,
yes, I sure will. I'm sorry that she wasn't here with me.
Well, we missed her, too, but you're a delight to interview, and I'm thrilled with your book. Congratulations.
Well, really appreciate it and really enjoy talking with you.
You too, Robert.
It's time to say goodbye until next week, but here's our usual sign-off from Mrs. Haig.
Bye-bye.